Okay, next on our agenda is agenda consultation and the trustees review of structure and effectiveness, and I think we will start with the agenda consultation. And I will hand over to April.
I didn't want to say very much except welcome April to the table. I think the big thing about the agenda consultation is if you read the document, it's very open, it asks very open questions about everything that we're working on. The reality is somewhat different in the sense that if you project forward what the staff are going to be working on the next 3 years, there is a high degree of, you can fix to a high degree what we're going to be doing, because we have to finish insurance, we have to keep working on disclosure initiatives, we will do follow-up work on leases, we have to finish conceptual framework, there'll be follow-up work on financial instruments, there's still some follow-up work on revenue. We will be working on the primary financial statements, which is the project on which we consider performance reporting. We will certainly be continuing to work on debt equity. So you can see there's a number of big projects which are just not going to go away. And so the degree of optionality, or whatever you want to call it, is much less than is implied by the document, I would say. What this document, though, really is about is, to the extent there is some optionality, and where we really would appreciate your feedback, we have a big research agenda at this point. We've got a lot of topics on the research agenda. And by dint of post-implementation reviews and other things, it kind of has this natural tendency to grow. And if you look at the topics on the research agenda, even if we could do them all, the world wouldn't have the capacity or want the capacity to absorb them. And so we need to do a fairly aggressive prioritisation of those research topics. And I think the board will need to make some tough decisions when we get to doing the feedback on the research agenda. That's a little bit of context.
Okay. This is slide pack 5 in your books. And as we said, we're looking at both the trustees' request for views and the agenda consultation. Firstly, the agenda consultation. We spoke to you earlier this year about the shape of the agenda consultation. And what we'd like to do today is give you a very brief update on the form of the final request for views. And we'll then ask you to discuss three questions. As Hugh said about the priority of the research projects, then whether we do enough and the right things to support implementation, and then finally whether we've got the right level of change. So on slide 4, we conducted our first agenda consultation in 2011, and at that time we got quite a lot of feedback from a wide range of stakeholders. We had more than 240 comment letters, and we had about 80 outreach meetings. And as a result of the consultation, the IFB agreed that we'd focus on completing the 4 major projects, the conceptual framework, which is fundamental to the development of individual IFRS, and maintenance and implementation issues. And we also agreed that we would find a way of developing an evidence-based form of standard setting. And I think over the months that we were developing the request for views, we realized how important it was to be clear about how the agenda setting process and the research program are interlinked. And in the request for views, we've set out a methodology for evidence-informed research, how it should affect the research program, and how that program should then support the rest of our technical activities. And we think that by making the standard-setting process clear, that should give more transparency about what criteria we use for deciding what topics we're going to take on, and what the relative priorities of the topic should be. And the articulation of that standard setting process is on slide 5. Agenda requests come from a variety of sources, as you can see. There's the 2011 agenda consultation and this one. There are submissions that come to the IFRIC, and that's quite a big source of implementation issues. And then there are post-implementations reviews. We've completed a post-implementation review on IFRS 8 and on IFRS 3. And we're planning to do IFRS 10, 11, 12, and 13 next year. Now, there's a relatively low hurdle to get onto the research project agenda. And in those projects, we analyze what the problem is, and we test potential solutions. The there's a higher hurdle to get onto the standards level program, and that's demonstrated by sort of a grey line on the diagram. And I think we've been quite clear for a while that not all research projects lead to a standards level project. And some of the factors that the ISB consider when they add the project to the standard level program is its importance to investors and other users of the financial statements, the types of entities that are affected, and how pervasive or acute the matter is. And then the third leg of the activities is the maintenance of IFRS, and that's often triggered by implementation issues. Slide six, the sort of the standing data for the 2015 agenda consultation. We're only asking questions about the composition, balance, and priorities of the work plan. Now, there's a clear link between the agenda consultation and the trustees' review. And a number of the strategic questions that David will talk to you about are effectively linked with this process. Questions like the wider corporate reporting developments, and also the effect of technology on our work. And because of this, the two consultations overlap in their timing. Agenda consultation is out until 31st of December, and the trustees is out for comment until 30th of November. Now, we also have an online survey, which was originally designed for investors, but we are actually asking anyone who wants to complete it. And in that, we ask people to just name their top three projects that they'd like the ISB to take on board, whether it's on the research agenda or not, just what's worrying people, and also to rate each of our existing research topics as high, medium, or low priority. On slide seven, there's an overview of the eight questions that are in the request reviews: balance of the ISB's activities, the composition of the research program and prioritizing the research program, an open question to comment on the work plan for major projects, a question about the maintenance and implementation activities, and a question about the level of change, and then other comments, a very open question on the work plan, and the frequency of the agenda consultations. Now, you're probably aware that we're required to consult on the agenda every 3 years, but given the life cycle of our projects, we're actually finding that we're consulting now on projects that we've consulted on in 2011. So in the request reviews, the ISB proposed that we make that interval 5 years, and we're asking people for comments on that. And today we're going to ask you about questions 3, 5, and 6. So that's the update on the request reviews. If we go on to the questions now, on the research program on slide 8, you can see that there are nearly 20 projects on the research program. And in the request reviews, we asked whether any research project should be added or removed from that agenda, how each project should be prioritized with respect to the relative importance and urgency, and what factors should be used in ascribing priorities. And I think that the factors that are used to ascribe the priorities will actually be a really interesting output from this process. When we did the 2011 agenda consultation and we were assessing the results, we tried to get some sort of matrix of how we could score the different priorities. And we thought about, is it the breadth of how many entities are affected? Is it the depth of how fundamental the effect on financial reporting would be? And this year we thought about things like, does it strengthen the relevance of IFRS? So for example, the disclosure initiative. Does it fill a gap, something like rate regulated, or would it improve consistency of application, which was the aim of revenue? So the question today for you, the first question, is what priority would you give the projects? And I think perhaps rather than trying to go through the projects one by one and agree a sort of a priority that you're all happy with, it might be an idea if you just nominate what you think the really top topics for the ISB to take on board should be.
Group and everybody is naming, or should we try that first? Yeah. We had the same discussion, I think, in the advisory council, and if the discussion is all over the place, I think it's really for us not helpful. So it would really good if it is possible, if this group can come up with, I think, some two or three priorities, because then it is, I think, at least helpful. We start with Shara. He give us the first priority.
Thank you, Chairman.
I would say that naming the priorities is easy for me. But before that, the thought I would have is, what are we trying to pursue as an objective with the research program? In fact, what's not really clear from the consultation is when we put an element in the research program, what is the objective? I can understand in the case of definition of business, because it has a lot of application and need a lot of studies on the existence of the different businesses. The business model is really galvauded, I would say in French. I don't know if it does exist in English, but everyone is speaking about business model. But in fact, when we looked at these the different type of activities that exist within companies, they are not not much business model. In fact, there are maybe two, maybe three, something like. So it's not so difficult to get to a definition. But beyond the definition, there is what we are going to do, what we want to do with the notion, the concept of a business model, and that's clearly a research element. But if I come to goodwill and impairment, I'm not so sure that it is something on which ISP is going to spend too much time, because finally the solution will be maybe driven by convergence strategy of ISP. Because let's suppose that the conclusion of the research, the assessment phase, is not to amortize for ISP, but it is to amortize for FISB. There would be a real problem for large companies all around the world, even if we are not really convergent, in fact. So this is not research-driven, I would say. Well, I don't know if you have the answer to the question I have for myself and for you, but as far as the elements that to be nominated to the research program for its business, discount rates, but probably due to the cross-cutting issues that relate to this discount rate, goodwill and impairment, because I think this is really important to amortize, but this is a personal view. And the other one is primary financial statements, because there is a very large diversity, and specifically in the financial industry, for the presentation of the performance, and there is something to do on that. On the P&L, but also on cash flow statements that are not really useful for the financial industry. So I don't know if in your mind this should be included in the primary financial statement, but there is an issue. Thank you. I'll stop here.
Thank you for that.
Peter, did you want to say anything?
Let me make a couple of comments. First of all, a general comment about what the research program's for. So the idea is that we look maybe more rigorously than we have in the past, and perhaps show more clearly than we have in the past that we've identified that a problem exists and what the problem is that we're trying to fix. So the hope is that if you've got a clearer idea of what the problem is, then that'll create a clearer path to the solution. Also identifying whether there's a feasible solution, because there might be something that's difficult, that's a problem, but it might be extremely difficult to resolve as well. So that's sort of at a high level what the objective of the research program is. You mentioned a definition of a business, and I think there might be a slight misunderstanding there, because what that project is about is the fact that there's a difference between the accounting for a business combination under IFRS 3 and the accounting for an acquisition of a group of assets. And there's been some uncertainty, and the post-implementation reviews show that there were some cases where it was quite difficult to identify whether it was a business or an asset acquisition. And in fact, it's something that's come up in this group before, actually. I remember Kevin's mentioned some difficulties in that area. So there, for example, we've established that a problem exists. But it's not about trying to define business model or anything like that. That's a completely separate exercise. It's trying to fix that particular problem that's been identified in the post-implementation review of IFRS 3. I think for that definition of a business one, we're really past the assessment phase now. In fact, the board's sort of done enough on that, and it's decided the next step is going to be moving forward towards an exposure draft. And of course, that's a converged standard. So that's an extra ingredient in the mix, is the desire to try and keep convergence if we reasonably can.
Thanks. Hiroshi?
Yeah. I think regarding a research program, there are too many research programs. We should prioritize the program. So in my view, high priority projects are goodwill impairment and principle of disclosure. And I give a low priority in a project of discount rates, income taxes, share-based payments, and equity methods. Others are somewhere in the middle. So I think goodwill and impairment is very important because it has a significant impact on the income statement. And principle of disclosure is very important, which is equivalent to conceptual framework. And in my view, the project of primary financial statement should be suspended because it's a revival of the performance reporting that was once suspended. And in my view, you should focus on such an agenda, such as the definition of operating income, and you should integrate this program into the principle of disclosure.
I'll just react a little bit to your comment on the primary financial statements. It is not intended to be a resurrection of the old FSP project, as was then known. I think it's fair to say we haven't got a crystal clear idea of what the end output will be, and that's partly why it's on the research programme, of course. But it is looking at the structure of primary financial statements. But I think, you know, one of the reasons for changing the name was to get away from this idea that actually what we're doing is resurrecting this previous project, because it's not intended to do that.
And on the operating income, I mean, that's something that consistently comes up in discussion. And in fact, when we did the outreach on the conceptual framework discussion paper, whenever we wanted to talk to users about profit or loss versus OCI, they weren't interested. They wanted to talk about operating income the whole time. So I think some look at that is inevitable in that research. Whether it will lead somewhere is another question, but I think it's inevitably one of the things that's a candidate for being included in the project.
Okay, Kevin?
I think with the abolishment of proportionate consolidation, the equity method and determination, is it a form of consolidation or is it a measure of value, is definitely an answer that's got to be run. And no, I'm not going to punt extractive activities. But what I am going to say is that given, since the last agenda consultation, we've had IFRIC 20, we've done testing, which they keep coming back to an industry. We've, what Gervais's been doing on IFRS 10, 11, and 12 is going to tell you that there's some issues in the joint arrangement standard that not get onto the extractive activities, but it's worthwhile getting into an industry and understanding if an industry has specific implementation issues, because it might then trigger to other ones. I had discussions with Gerard yesterday about some of the comments and issues he's been dealing with on joint arrangements, and gave him information that we've now had in South Africa where the real estate industry is also having issues with joint arrangements. So choosing an industry and seeing if they've got implementation issues may give knock-on consequences, and say, then volunteer the extractive activities to choose the industry. And let's get down and start eliminating the exceptions. There's all these scope exceptions in all of the standards for an industry. So if the scope exceptions are not relevant anymore because you've investigated the industry, then eliminate them and let's avoid some of the complexity.
Pat, you want to give us your three priorities?
Yeah, I actually don't necessarily want to opine on any of these, but I want to just raise your attention to an issue and ask you to think about it as a group, because you guys would be directly affected by it. In today's New York Times, there is yet another article dealing with the presentation disclosure of non-GAAP measures. And this one has to deal with a company that's been in the financial press a lot lately, Valeant, a pharmaceutical company. But it's been topical for many, many companies, particularly companies in the IPO market. So my question for you is, do you think there's any urgency for the IASB to put on its agenda something that would deal quickly, not as part of the disclosure initiative, not as part of primary financial statements that will take 4, 5, 6, 10 years, whatever, to complete, or however long it takes to complete. Something that we should deal with post haste that would, you know, be completed, let's say, in no less than 24 months. Simply because of the proliferation and controversy around this subject, it's getting so much attention. Should we cede this to the securities regulators, or should we, in fact, deal with it more directly? I'm just curious what your views are, whether you're say, leave it the way it is.
Pat, that actually goes to, if I may, what I was wanting to talk about. I think, I don't want you to take this the wrong way, but I think you need to be bolder in how you structure the agenda. And personally, I'd like you to make sure that you think about, you know, things that are on the minds of my CFO, users, analysts. So I'd like you to structure the agenda around what's improving communication, what's improving relevance. Communication, to my mind, is exactly to the point you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
I personally do believe the whole debate about whatever you want to call it, core or non-GAAP or whatever, segmentation, I think personally that's, I mean, I actually disagree. I think we do need to do something to make our financial statements more accessible and how our analysts want to use them. So you know, you've got a lot of technical points here, but I'm not sure. I'd like you to go a bit, raise it up a bit higher somehow. You know, what can we do, as I say, to improve relevance? And the other area I think I'd like you to put as a criteria, those areas that bring what I would term IFRS into disrepute. And here I'm back to my hobby horse of your absolute failure to give guidance how to account for complex situations like Venezuela, where we have a completely different model between US GAAP and IFRS. No one understands why there's a completely different model. And you know, so to my mind, that's one area where you, bluntly, you're putting your head in the sand and not facing up to an issue. And it is an issue. Okay, so that's my, you know, that's my, I'm, I don't know, stuck a record stuck in the groove. I'm an old-fashioned guy. I don't know what it is in sort of today's, way of playing music, but you know. Stuck in that groove. So, yeah, I think to your point, I believe you do want to have with some urgency, a program to make some of these points to the point to improve relevance and communication of our financial figures.
How would you suggest we go about that, Malcolm? I mean, you said we've got a list of sort of technical sounding issues here.
I mean, some you could group together, clearly disclosure principles, disclosure, primary financial statement, all these touch upon somehow this need to communicate better, but you haven't included in that. I know we've talked about it in the conceptual framework, whether or not somehow segmentation or, you know, somehow core earnings should be swept up in the conceptual framework. But out there, the real world is doing that. And we can't wait 5 years for you to, or 10 years for you to come up with an answer. The real world is already doing it.
Could I react a little bit? Just to reassure you, firstly, in the principles of disclosure paper that's coming out early next year, we will be touching on communication, and we will have a section on non-GAAP measures. And the board has had that discussion. If so many companies are reporting so many non-GAAP measures, then there is a debate about relevance. And what the board has said, and where we are at this point, and I think what will be reflected in the discussion paper, is to say, rather than get hung up on what the definition of a non-GAAP measure is, or whatever you want to call it, alternative performance measure, let's set out criteria which would enable these measures to be presented fairly, so it's not a complete free-for-all. And then if you meet those criteria, then there may be a case to put them into directly into the main financial statements rather than the front half of the report. I think on relevance, there is some... We're going to hear quite a few, based on our outreach on the agenda consultation, a lot of people are talking about relevance, and they're talking about things like, you know, what is the gap between book value and market value? Why is it so big? And what are the things which are missing? And you can quickly get onto debate about intangible assets, but it's not just intangibles. And I think we'll have to make some interesting calls about that. On the point about the general point, and I wanted to make this point when Joanna was here, but this is an equally relevant point to make it about this financial statements or an annual report being, is it an instrument of communication or is it a compliance exercise? Wearing a different hat in a previous life, I once wrote this report called Making Corporate Reports Readable, and it had a particular thing inviting top management to set out its story in a short number of pages, 20 or 30 pages. What was interesting about it, though, is there is nothing, certainly in this country, and we did a little bit of research for overseas countries, that there is nothing stopping companies doing this right now. There's no legal impediment. Yeah. So the question is, if it's so important to you, why don't you produce these communication documents? And I don't know what the answer to that is. We found it very hard to get traction, because this report would be over and above your 400-page annual report. It would be a 30-page document, wholly consistent with the annual report to the extent you can be in such a short number of pages, suitably caveated for all kinds of good reasons, giving key disclosure indicators, key performance indicators, how you were performing against your peers, all the things that you might think in top management would be good things to say if you only had 30 pages, telling the story in the end. And yet we couldn't get the traction, and the best we could get was, we need a regulator to tell us to do it. And this, I just don't get, I can't connect these two things that we hear. You know, we hear that it's so important to have these communication documents, but there's nothing stopping you, so why don't you do them anyway?
We do it in our press release that looks very different to our normal financial statements. We do it.
So what is it you're asking us to do?
Well, I've always, for many years, been saying I think these sort of many of these non-GAAP measures can be legitimized. They actually, you know, are based on what's in the financials. They're not so many how many people have clicked on your website. I mean, they're coming from the financial data and from the general ledgers. So why can't we find a way to sort of legitimize them and stop this? You know, it's obviously very negative. Many of these things have a very negative connotation because they are considered somehow not to smell very good.
But we are pressing.
They tend to be
next
bigger.
First quarter 2016, we'll come up with an exposure draft, and I think we have also a paragraph or more paragraphs on this kind of non-GAAP financial measures.
Okay.
And asking for advice.
I look forward.
Because I'm not sure. What should we do? Should we really allow that for all? Should we all give some rules with that? Because nobody's giving really the answer. It is okay. What would you in detail do about that? Because I think that is difficult, a very difficult question. I think in the interest of time, we have now three comments and then we move to the next. First, Olivia.
Yes, personally, I like the SBA to be, I would say,
legal measures, gap measures. And if there are no non-gap measures, maybe you should ask yourself, as you did, why is there non-gap measures? Are the way we propose financial statement to be a good representative of the performance, the situation, and so on. So, so that's the first step. The second step is, I think that the communication is not only on financial statements. You have all other documents, management commentary, presentation, and so on. We have already an obligation from the regulator to non-gap measure to explain, detail, and to give definition of the non-gap measure, to keep them time to time, to if it, there is any change, explain why there is a change, and to link them with the financial statement. And I think that it's the role of the regulator to ask for that, I would say, to do that practice, in fact. I don't think, I personally don't think that if you give a definition of a non-GAAP measure, it will you will have no more non-other GAAP measure presented by groups, because anytime you will describe a GAAP measure, a non-GAAP measure, it will become the GAAP measure, I would say, and of course, if once it does not fit with the representation of the reality, the different industries will find other gap non-gap measure, I would say. So I think that the best you can do is make good gap measure and let the regulator ask for more link with the financial data.
Thank you for that. Jacques?
Just a quick comment. I think what is missing in you know, these different actions or subjects, you know, in the research program, it's the overall logic. You know, why do we want to work on those items, and how would those items relate, you know, to broader projects? And I think it appears too much as a list, and I think it can give a negative impression, you know, from the outside, that you know, there is a lot of small items which are worked on independently, maybe from broader projects. So I think you should really try to build up the overall logic of why has this those priorities, and how do they relate with broader projects.
I think that's a fair point. Actually, we had some discussion when we were putting the request for views together about whether we should try to paint all of these issues around one theme, like some kind of common theme, and we had various debates, and actually Hans even forced me to do an exercise, which was to put all the projects into one of three columns, and they were, from memory, and I can only choose one column for each project, so they were things like completing the IFRS literature, improving consistency, strengthening relevance. And it was a bit artificial, so in the end we didn't do it, but we've heard this point quite a lot, and I think it's valid to say, although we do say in the document, here's factors to consider when prioritising, what we don't really do is give a really persuasive strategic framework, if you like, to think about prioritisation. And I think when we do the feedback statement, and we've heard it enough, and I think it's valid actually, we're going to need to give the feedback around some kind of theme, maybe more than one theme, but to make some links between the projects, to give somehow tell a story which hangs together, because otherwise it looks all a little bit random, and I think it's a fair point.
The advisory council small group had the same view.
Same view. We've heard it. We've heard it in ESMA. We heard it in Japan. I mean, I think it's a fair comment.
Kevin.
Thanks. I'm on Olivia's page, but I think if you think you're going to come up with a standard that's going to abolish non-GAAP measures, it's not going to happen. So effectively, I think you could take
that
it on.
That wasn't what I said.
Yeah. I think you could take it on as a project similar to a post-implementation review and use it as a self-critique. So is the non-GAAP measure endemic? across all industries, they're all doing it, well, that's an indicator of something wrong with the standard. Is the non-gap measure specific to specific industries? That might be that there's something wrong with implementation in that industry. And if you use it as a post-implementation self-critique, as opposed to non-gap measures are bad, they're not necessarily bad. When I look at ours, they're not the, you know, sales to customers things. It's a reconciliation of our contracts on debt to prove what our debt covenant is. It's other ones that our local regulator specifically requires. We don't have anything that's really left field. Find out what they are and use them as a PIR, as opposed to let's ban these things, they're bad.
There was an interesting academic research forum in Hong Kong which we attended, and one of the papers had done a pile of analysis about non-GAAP measures in Australia, and it had concluded that, just what you said actually, that there isn't anything necessarily
negative.
There isn't deliberate management bias going on to flatter the results, was basically the conclusion of this paper. What it said was, these companies are being responsive to what users are asking for in large part, and the numbers do go both ways. I think different analysis says different things. I know Hans gave a speech saying that actually when you look at a lot of these numbers, sometimes they do flatter the GAAP results, but I think provided, and where we've got to, and we're not trying to destroy non-GAAP measures by any means, what we're trying to do is say, if you present a non-GAAP measure, here are some criteria which we would hope to see reflecting, making that measure fairly presented. And I think that's fine. I would say there is pushback in different jurisdictions on this, though, and Australia is probably the one where we've got a lot of pushback. I mean, the regulators have been very particular in that jurisdiction. We're going to have to strike a balance, I think.
Yeah, but I think also for the primary financial statements project, I think one thing we absolutely do need to do is to try and see what messages we can learn from the common types of non-GAAP measures to see whether there are things that we should be trying to import into the GAAP measures.
Gary?
Quickly, just Kevin, I think you'll see in the principle of disclosures document, some of this is going to be explored as well, because so there's multiple types of non-GAAP measures, some of which are nothing specifically authorized or promulgated by ourselves, but is useful. There's other ones where we don't like your answer and we don't like share-based compensation as an expense, so you carve it out. And then there's a question about what do you do about operational statistics, if vehicles sold or tons shipped. I mean, we don't specify that. I don't think we're going to dwell much on it in there, but why not? You know, and sort of asking the question. So it comes in a lot of flavors. The one obviously problematic is one that basically contradicts or supersedes in the exact opposite direction something that we require. And then you got like the issue, and I don't know if it's going to be in POD or it's going to be in primary financial statements project. If you've got a P&L of natural items, you could have a subtotal of EBITDA. If you've got one by functional items, you cannot. So why is it permitted depending on the format of your P&L and so on. So between the two projects, those questions are going to get a lot of attention.
Okay, and April, maybe you have not received your three priorities, but at least
we got the message that we need a kind of overall theme, or that okay, it's packaged more, that it makes really, from a strategic perspective, a lot of sense. So I think that was advice. But I think we have two other questions on the agenda.
Very quickly, two more questions. On slide 10, what can we do to support maintenance and consistent application? We meet obviously in lots of groups with people to find out what the problems are, and we have lots of forums like this where we talk to people. The interpretations committee is probably our first line of receiving submissions from people about implementation issues. We've also got a number of other support activities like the education activities and IFRS taxonomy and translation, where if something can be translated consistently, then that helps consistent application. But the question today for you is there anything that the ISB and the Interpretations Committee could do to improve implementation support? And do you feel you're getting enough support?
Any comments?
The answer is I don't think you're doing enough support because of this multi-jurisdictional implementation issues that we keep bumping into.
But is it our job or auditors?
Well,
or
I don't know. That's what I say. I don't know whether it's your job or not. But one of the ways in which you might be able to help remove it, and maybe you're doing it behind the scenes anyway, is, you know, in the big four books, which have got differences in, either tell them to correct them, or not, give some type of wink-wink that we know that those diversities are acceptable. Because it's a huge debate for us as preparers when I take the Deloitte's book and I take the Pricewaterhouse book, and there's two different opinions, but my also Ernst & Young, and I have three views, and I'm quite happy with one, but it's not my auditor's one. Oh, well, they're wrong. It's like, they're not wrong. That's not so simple as you should. So I think, you know, if you have the ability to look at their books and see the differences, so either, you know, do a wink-wink that those differences are acceptable in terms of the board, or make them change. That would help to at least progress in some of the implementation issues.
But the firms should not be setting gaps.
They are.
And I know that they are, but everything should come back to the underlying standards. And if you disagree with the firms, then you should make a firm stand and use the standard setting processes to be able to address it. You know, we've done that before when we've had disagreements, but the firm's book should just be one source of potential interpretations.
And I agree to that, but is that, and if the preparers can really not give enough pressure to the audit firms to change their mind, if it is from other audit firms acceptable, so maybe there is a kind of interpretation room. Mm. And I totally agree the accounting firm should not say then, okay, that is our interpretation, but we don't agree with another firm interpretation. But do you think the IISB can make such pressure if the preparers cannot make such pressure to the auditors? I don't think so.
But preparers lose. I've got a deadline, I've got a reporting date. I haven't got the luxury of 18 months to prepare a document. But if you give me a hotline, an urgent issues task force, where you actually will take on the responsibility of fighting out these implementation issues, then we'll use it. But if I've got to send it through the IFRIC, I'll surrender, because I haven't got to, I can't delay my financials for 2 years waiting for an IFRIC. I can't do it.
But if we are should do it, we are think then agenda consultation is very easy, and we should do the next 5 years
clearing the
solving these conflicts between the accounting firms.
You know, they are your standards.
Best use of our time.
No, but they are your standards. And if you're not going to take ownership and enforce ownership, then you are doing yourselves a disservice.
Yeah, but we haven't. We have, I think, a kind of, we have the IFRIC, we say, okay, if there is diversity in views and if it is certain criteria, okay, that it is really kind of a problem, then that should be solved there. What should we do in addition to that? I acknowledge,
I was a preparer for 12 years. I hear what, you know, the speed at which we get stuff through, I acknowledge that point.
But that's the next question, man. This is speed, man. Maybe it is okay, but I don't think we should do more in this, because I think the more and more we come into the rules-based standard setting, and if we try to solve all this kind of conflicts, and I don't think it is the right way. If there is room for interpretation, I think it should be also the preparer should go to the audit firms and say, okay, if it is accepted by another accounting firm, why can you say it is not accepted by you? It's obviously an interpretation which you can. But okay, so this. Any other comments on the implementation? Otherwise, we go to question three.
And the final question is, some people say that we make too many changes to IFRS. Others think that we're not putting through enough improvements which should be prioritised. So the final question is, do you think we've got the balance of change right or wrong? And do you think we give the right level of detail of that guidance when we do issue it?
When I heard from this group, I think it was one of the this year's meeting also, that we have too many narrow scope amendments and trying to solve these smaller issues. And what is your feeling really about that? Should we do more? Should we do less? Or is it all okay?
ways to happen like that. I think the proof will be in the pudding in what your revenue transition group has done and how that would help stop implementation issues and how the impairment transition group will help stop implementation issues. Those two might be good experiments that reduce future IFRICs. And as much as you don't like them, and I support that they shouldn't exist, you need to have a small circle that maybe you don't necessarily make public, where you can bounce these type of processes in prior to a standard coming in, that you can help stop the small changes because you've dealt with it pre-implementation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Hiroshi?
I still think the pace of change is too rapid, and currently a major project are finalized or will be finalized in the near future. And in the stage of agenda consultation 2050, I really hope the stable platform and period of calm. So to attain this, you should focus on maintenance and interpretation rather than a big project. And I mentioned you should focus on number of projects, even in research project.
Okay.
In Europe, between 2002 and 2018, we will have had 6 years preparing a project to endorse IFRS, either the first endorsement and application in 2005, or all the new IFRS that are in the, that are being in prepared and published and endorsed by Europe. There were two huge projects, in fact. In the case of BNP Paribas, this project in 2000, between 2002 and 2005, it was, I must say, with Basel II, it was a 100 million euro project, and probably it's several tens million from now to 18 to prepare IFRS 9 and insurance and so on. That's really too much, and this is not sustainable for the companies to engage so much funds for accounting purposes. Without, we have seen in the discussion today, a real improvement in terms of communication and explanation of the business to the market. So I think that there is really an issue on that. The other thought I have is in the case of IFRS 9, finally, was it really necessary to change completely IS 39 to produce IFRS 9. I'm thinking about recognition and measurement. In fact, what was requested in 2008 and 2009 was specifically the impairment model to be completely reviewed, which has been done, and could have been done much more quickly than has been done, in fact. And probably the world would be more satisfied, or would have been more satisfied, to have 39 completely reviewed on the model, on the expected model, but very quickly, than to have IFRS 9 with all the difficulties that we meet currently. To have this standard endorsed by Europe for different reasons, including insurance and so on.
Well, I don't agree with that, because at that time I was working in a bank, and it was especially divergence between what US banks have done and European banks, especially in classification and measurement, and there was a huge confusion about really what is possible in the US. We have the same products here in Europe, they do different accounting, and we cannot compare it, and why is all that different, and there's not a level playing field. And therefore, I think it was at that point in time not only really the impairment rules which were criticized, it was also recognition and measurement rules, and especially what is fair valued, what is not fair valued, and I think that was also the reason why I think the board at that point in time had not only addressed really that kind of impairment, and there was this big call of too complex, too many kind of categories, and this makes our whole comparability too complex, and that was also discussed at that point in time, also on political level.
You are right. Yeah. If we had the chance to achieve a convergence on that, it was worldwide. Was why to do the exercise, but finally we didn't achieve
that. Right. And that you are right, I agree.
Yes, there seems to, in fact, for Chinese enterprises, we do not see too much changes because we just implement these rules a couple of years, about 10 or 12 years. And for my first involvement in the business in 1993, the Chinese parties just, Minister of Finance announced a new accounting standard that's based on marketing diversity, change from the planning economy. So from our side, we didn't think it's too much changes. In fact, it changes too much for us. But maybe if you've studied IFRS history, a lot of the different preparers or the users of this accounting standard thinks you change a lot, because that's changing is different with their business. So I think the change is changing or not, it depends on their users. If they think their business doesn't change and you change the rules, they think you change too much. But for very, a lot of for new business style is coming up in the recent years. But we found that our standards haven't changed quick enough to fulfill with this kind of business change. So my personal thinking is for those those rules, those standards is implemented now, maybe we try to keep it stable, but maybe the IFRS should do more in advance to try to guide some kind of the new business styles, like those kind of internet business or carbon pollution, this kind of we need to go further step ahead of the business styles. So that's what will much helpful to increase the IFRS the power, and all the new business style try to implement it. Because in China, we think the Ministry of Finance agreed to use the IFRS as our standard, so all the enterprises have to follow this. So that's why I think that we should think this in a different way to keep this stable for the current roles, and try to find new roles for the new business in advance.
Could I ask Hiroshi a question?
Yeah.
I think you said you'd like a stable platform, but you also said that goodwill was a very high priority, and I'd be quite interested to know how high a priority it is and what distinguishes it from the things that you think we shouldn't change.
Financial instruments.
No church anymore.
So regarding the maintenance, it's okay. Nobody's
sure,
okay.
Sure. Mm-hmm. But I think you suggested that we should look again at goodwill amortization, which I think is a bit more than just maintenance, probably.
Mm.
So that I think that goes a little bit against a stable platform. So I'm trying to understand sort of where your threshold is and what's pushing you to want that one particularly.
Yeah.
Not necessarily to answer today, but I think in any comment as you're involved with it would be helpful if you're giving both those messages, if you could try and explain as clearly as possible why the ones you identify as high priorities really are high, you think are worth disrupting the stable platform for.
But regarding goodwill amortization, it's a project cooperating with the FSB, mm-hmm. and this is adding just one major project. So since it's very important and it's related to the P&L has a significant effect, so I put the priority in that project.
Okay. I think that's it for agenda consolidation, and would like to move now to David's topics regarding effectiveness and strategy.
Thanks, Martin. Well, I think many of the issues we've already touched on, both in the session you've just had with Joanna and in what we've just discussed. A brief bit of background, and I'm on slide 15, is that the trustees are required under the Foundation's constitution to do a review of the entire structure and effectiveness of the organisation every 5 years. As it happens, in 15 years, this is the fifth major review. But yeah, putting that to one side and review fatigue. The context we've had is that the trustees have set out a strategic overview for this year through to the end of 2017. With four primary goals. So one is around the single set of principle-based financial reporting standards, with relevance being the key issue there, and we've already talked quite a lot about that. The pursuit of global adoption of IFRS, the trustees are not planning to review at this stage. I mean, we had a little bit of discussion around the politics of convergence and the FASB earlier. And I think one other thing I would mention is, of course, that with the establishment of the Accounting Standards Advisory Forum, that is a signal that we've moved, while convergence remains important, from a bilateral to a multilateral world and a multilateral engagement, of which FASB is a important member of that group. Third issue is consistent application and implementation, and that fits to some of the issues that are coming out in the agenda consultation as well, so there's a fair degree of overlap there, although from our perspective we're trying to look at it from the strategy of the organisation as a whole. And the fourth issue is around ourselves as an organisation, trying to remain independent, stable, including financially stable and accountable. So if I look at our first goal, which is around the single set of standards, as well as the issue of, you know, do you get into the whole world of non-GAAP alternative performance measures, the trustees' view is that this is an issue for the board to tackle, and you've already heard some of the things that the board are planning and the input that Kevin and others have given on that already. Wider corporate reporting, you obviously gathered from Joanna's comments that she has strong views on this, and we've set out where we think the board, well, does sit at the moment and should sit. So in effect, we're not saying we're going to grab the whole of the integrated reporting agenda and take it off the IARC and run with it. What we do is we have an MOU with the IARC, we cooperate very closely with them, and they have a corporate reporting dialogue that meets with certain standard setters in various different areas of corporate reporting, and we keep close tabs on that. So it's a kind of looking at the radar screen and being aware of what's coming up there. We've also asked the question, because we've had to do, because we said we would do in previous reviews, you know, should we extend the remit of the board either to the public sector or to the private not-for-profit sector. Public sector, I think we're clearly saying no,
there's the IPSASB, the International Public Sector Accounting Standards Board. There's recently been a review of its governance and a new mechanism set up. We're asking the question about private not-for-profits. I guess I suspect I know what your answer might be, whether we go into that territory, but the question is there. And then in the issue of taxonomy and technology, we're asking, are you okay with the strategy for the taxonomy, where we've moved away from the kind of computer language, so we don't refer specifically to XBRL anymore. We're focusing on the content of the taxonomy, and we're looking, I guess, more to the needs of regulators and the developments in the regulatory world. And those of you involved in the European Union will have seen a recent consultation from ESMA, the Securities Authority, that's talking about a European single electronic format and the proposal to mandate the use of the IFRS taxonomy for certain categories of companies from 2020. That's out for consultation at the moment. And the last point under this is, again, I think encouraged by the Advisory Council, they've said, well, what are you doing to take account of wider technological developments? The unstructured data, big data, they've bandied terms around us. And we sort of sat there and thought, what do you mean by that? And they've not quite articulated it. And so our consultation includes a kind of plea for help to say, should we have a similar radar screen that we do for the wider corporate reporting to pick up what's going on in the wider technological world? And is that going to have an impact on the role of financial statements, not only within wider corporate reporting, but within the delivery mechanisms of technology? So that, I think you've answered some of these questions already, but it's whether you had any immediate reactions, views about the relevance of IFRS being maintained in the tsunami of different things that's out there. Overwhelmed.
Just first.
Yeah. I don't agree to expand your scope to non-profit sectors and public sectors, because you will lose your focus and you will need additional fund. You will not be able to persuade us to give additional fund for that purpose. And regarding the scope of integrated reporting, it's okay for GISB to cooperate with this project. But in my view, you should not play a major role for this project, because it's a voluntary disclosure and it's in an early stage. I think you should focus on the development of accounting standards of private sector.
Okay. Moving on, consistent application, we've already given it a pretty good going over. I mean, what the trustees document here sets out, it looks back to the last strategy review and sets out a number of the things that the trustees then felt were important and continue to feel are important in helping consistent application. So clear, understandable, enforceable standards, a principle-based approach to standard setting. And we do, Kevin, refer to the TRGs having been set up, but we've been careful to say we don't regard them as something for every standard. And what we want to do is to review the experience and see how they work out in practice and whether they ultimately do help to lessen the need for future IFRICs.
It's one of those things you'll never know.
At this stage, yeah, but we don't know.
And you won't know, because how do you know what things would have occurred? It's just like, you just don't know.
We also refer to cooperation with a variety of partners, especially securities regulators, and we have MOUs with IOSCO, with ESMA. There's regular dialogue with IOSCO, and what we're trying to do is to get much more dialogue going with them. I think it's working pretty well, and Hugh and a number of colleagues were over in at IOSCO meetings in Hong Kong last week.
We also do educational seminars for regulators.
And then, you know, should we be looking more, you know, we have our links to national accounting bodies, national standard setters, audit regulators. There's a lot going on, particularly in the financial services side with the Basel Committee as well. Work of the Interpretations Committee, April's touched on that. And one thing that's coming up is the role of our education activities. Is there more we could be doing here? At the moment, we have a very small education initiative team who do a fair amount of train the trainers, put out material to try and understand things. But should there be more we're doing in that space? And then if you're looking at post-implementation reviews, we've had two so far on IFRS 8 and IFRS 3. Yeah. And Peter's alluded to, as a result of the IFRS 3 PIR, we've got something coming through on the definition of the business and as well on goodwill and impairment. So is there more, you know, is, given our constraints and limitations, is there more you think we could or should be doing to help in this space? Now, Kevin, I know you mentioned some
very specific news.
You know, how we get across the cultural issues and, you know, Northern Hemisphere, Southern Hemisphere, I just don't know. It's a bit like rugby if you look at it that way as well. But any other views would be gratefully received. April's ground you, exhausted you. Okay, the last thing to touch on is ourselves as an organisation. And we ask a range of questions. I don't know how much you know about the organisation, but we have the board that sets the standards, overseen by the trustees, and then and that's the foundation. And we are then accountable to a monitoring board of capital markets authorities. So you have the SEC, you have the Financial Services Agency of Japan, you've got the European Commission, a number of other regulators are involved, Brazil, Korea, and that's our accountability, the public accountability link, because we are an unusual organisation. And we went through looking at that structure as part of the last strategy review in 2011-2012. The monitoring board did its own review, and the message came back loud and clear. The structure's fine, so we're not touching that, but we're asking, is there any way you think the functioning could be improved? One of the important things we think is that helps to give a buffer to maintain the independence of the board in its standard setting, even though if you have an independent board, they come to independent decisions, and not all of you may like the independent decisions it comes to. We also have to look at a number of things regarding composition of trustees, and I particularly focused on one thing is that there's a proposal in there to reduce the size of the board. The constitution at the moment says 16 members. The board's currently operating with 14 because we haven't refilled a couple of posts. The proposal is to go down one more to 13, and again, that's a smaller board. The way it's been operating is thought to have been more effective and efficient, but we're asking the question of constituents, do you agree with that or not? And we're getting sort of fairly mixed views back as well.
Is it worth saying, by the way, David, that one of the concerns we've got with this consultation, as with any consultation, is that the people who reply are self-selecting. So generally, only people who are unhappy about things actually reply. So we're sort of expecting that for these questions, are you happy with the three-tier governance? Anyone who is happy with it isn't going to say anything, and so we're just going to get no answers to that. So that's one of the reasons why we're trying to raise awareness of this.
Sorry. So it's not that I'm not happy with it, but I think, well, it's not. Where the IASB board members were under David Tweedy was absolutely correct. But then you only had 30 countries adopting IFRS. So now with 140, it starts to look for us smaller countries, like you've got a Security Council with entrenched positions. So you're going to have to make the call. Are you really going for geographical distribution, or are you really going for market cap? You know, if you go for market cap, you can keep the Americans on. If you go for geographical distribution, you can't. So, you know, and I'm on the page of market cap because it's, you know, if I come from one continent, I come from a continent, I'm here in theory representing 54 separate countries. Mm. And maybe in terms of market cap, that's the right perspective. But, you know, you're not where you were 10 years ago, and that Security Council position has to start evolving. Same as South Africa's lobbying for the Security Council of the United Nations to change. So here's another lobby where the Security Council needs to change.
Sure.
On the functioning of the three tier governance structure, I would say that I have no idea because I have some difficulties to understand what is the role and of the monitoring board and what he has effectively done since its creation. So maybe it's useful, but I don't know. Maybe I didn't spend too much time or enough time to read the minutes, if there are minutes, and to see what has been the outcome of their meetings. On the size of the ISB, I mean the board that is represented today. I think that there is a paradox to reduce the number of members of the board when the use of ISB is expanding and becoming more and more global. So I don't really understand the rationale, except maybe for budget reasons, but it's probably not a good reason for doing that, because at the level of the world, the budget of ISB is something small, so it's immaterial, I would say.
Globally speaking,
the board of the ISB is immaterial. Now we know what materiality means.
£25 million.
Yes.
Is that your sentence?
A bag of shells.
To write the check.
Love to receive it.
Okay. So there is a paradox, and that I don't really understand. Probably there are continents within the world that would be happy to be better represented. As far as the geographical distribution is concerned, I would say that as a European, convinced European, I must only say that there are those using IFRS that should be represented on the board. And that doesn't mean that, for example, the US representative must be put out of the board. That's not what I want to say. But they should not represent an important part of the board itself. I fully understand that these companies, these corporates that are cross-listed, need to be represented in the board because they have an interest to be. They have the interest that the board consider their own situation in the different continents on which their equity is quoted. So we need necessary to have Americans representative within the board, but not necessary at the level where they are represented today.
Okay, Yaroshi.
I have a comment regarding the size of the board, and I don't support to reduce the number to 13. And if it were reduced to 13, I'm afraid that members representing Asia and Oceania region might be reduced from 4 to 3. This Asia and Oceania region has many countries and its economies are expanding. So considering the role of liaison, I think the number of board members should not be reduced. And I have a comment regarding the fund issues. And as I pointed out, the the ISP should focus prioritize the project, and if you attain a period of calm, so you will be able to reduce cost rather than increase the fund. You should consider to reduce the cost. And I have one comment regarding education. I request you to improve the homepage of education and on the page of ISB. I try to access the depreciation, education materials of depreciation. It was very difficult to get to the material. I get to the material through the homepage of ASVJ. it was very easy. So you please provide the at the grants for what kind of education materials on your homepage.
I'll note the first two comments, and on the third, we actually have a project to look at the website as a whole and to change it, so hopefully the navigation of the whole site will become easier and communication clearer. But I'll feed that into the website project team that we've set up. So thanks for that.
Okay.
You have to know as the board, you know, whether you can work with so many members. But I mean, tends to be, I think, in the States, is it five or seven?
Seven.
I mean, it does seem rather cumbersome how many you've got. I understand you've got all these political dimensions you have to consider, and so you have to weigh that up. Similarly with the trustees. I also share a little bit Gerard's view. I mean, you've got a lot of advisors, including us. I know you have to reach out all the time to the advisory council, but just outside looking in, it does seem you have an awful lot of advice. Mm. So I don't know. I mean, was that your question, Martin? You know, are we doubling up this organization, capital markets, with the advisory? Is there a bit of a concern we are? I don't know. It's something to perhaps think about.
There is an annual review done of all the consultative groups that the board has.
Mm.
And I think it's fair to say in the last couple of years that some of the groups, some of them sit there. I mean, this is an active group.
Mm.
But some of them, particularly on the project specific side, have sat there for a while and not met for a long while. And so we've started to encourage the disbandment and take a look overall.
Now, a very concrete point I've raised before, but it's not been action, that relates to your funding. We're having that debate actually in Switzerland, you know. I mean, I don't think it's unfortunately in many countries politically possible, but working with a levy based on market capitalization to fund you, I mean, me personally,
yeah.
I think that would be perhaps a preferable one. I mean, at the moment your funding comes perhaps disproportionately from the accounting companies and other people. A very simple solution, though, for those of us that are double listed, I actually, in order to maintain our US listing, we actually have to pay, based on our market capitalization, we have to pay a fee to the FASB.
Mm-hmm.
I forget what our fee is, but it's I think around about 100,000. And personally, I think there might have been arguments for that when we had to do a bridge to US GAAP. But I personally feel you should very actively follow up with the SEC. Why on earth? I mean, the SEC can still demand the levy, but why does the funding go
to the FASB?
Why does it go to the FASB and not to you? There must be, you should do some research on that, but it must be several millions actually out there that's going to the FASB. I think you should look at that pretty quickly. I mean, I've raised it before, no action. As far as I know, perhaps you are looking at it.
Yeah, we have regular dialogues with the SEC, is all I'll say.
But, I mean, we just have to do it because otherwise we get delisted.
In South Africa, it's funded by our government regulator, who then
that there's a whole range of arrangements, a particular arrangement in France. There's one in the UK where it is a levy as part of the levy for the Financial Reporting Council.
And that's why it might be better if you lobby through IOSCO, but force it down back to their regulator to make them do the collection. Because I know our stock exchange is more than willing, but they want an instruction from IOSCO. They don't want to just set it up as a transaction tax themselves.
We've been exploring every avenue. The difficulty is we don't have the force of mandating. And that's the issue that we face. Okay, well, thank you for that. I mean, in terms of next steps, we've got the comment period closes for the trustees review on the 30th of November. All comment letters welcome, and then that for the agenda consultation closes on the 31st of December. And then what we plan to do is there'll be a comment letter summary. We'll go to the trustees at their January meeting, something more involved for their May meeting, by which time we'll have fed in the overlap and the cross-fertilisation with the responses to the agenda consultation. So hopefully towards the end of the first half of next year there should be something in terms of white smoke or two puffs of white smoke coming out from this organisation, both on the strategic side and on where the board plans to go on its agenda. So that nothing else. Thank you for your time and participation.
It's still awake.
Yeah.
Perhaps we ask Frank.
Do you want coffee?
Do you want to stay with us, Frank? It must be well past midnight in Australia now.
Can't hear. He's on mute.
We're just waking you up, that's all.
You're on mute.
We just wondered whether you would already fallen asleep.
2:30 a.m.
Yeah. You're on mute.
You're still muted, I think.
You're on.
Sorry. Okay. Maybe one last comment from my side to that. As April said, I think it is important because you know that we are questioned by certain groups about our governance structure and others, that they have criticisms, that all the people who find that okay should have given all the comments, because otherwise it is a little bit not balanced. So even if you feel that something is fine, it would be appreciated if we get a comment. Thank you for that. Then we have a break and we'll come back at 3:45.